Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to this week's broadcast from River of Life Fellowship Church in Copenhagen, New York. This week, Pastor George Gray shares about Paul's journey to Governor Felix and how he was never promised a smooth road, only a destination. Here is part 44 of our Acts series with a message titled, God Always Has a Plan.
This is where Paul is actually moving from Jerusalem on his way to Rome, and so when you read through chapter 23, it doesn't necessarily look like there's a ton going on, but there actually is. There's an amazing end point in this particular chapter that's been being built up to for a number of other chapters. But when we left Paul, he was under guard by the Romans. He had just been beaten almost to death. And before the Romans had hauled him off because they were going to beat a confession out of him for an offense he didn't commit, they just needed something to hold him. They find out he's a Roman citizen. Suddenly, all the Roman guards are his best friend. But now we're in this situation where there's this problem. Paul is in custody. The Jewish leaders are saying he violated the law. So now everyone is stuck in this place where the legal system has been activated. And now you have to walk through the whole process. And so Paul has been moving towards this. I don't think any of this was a surprise to Paul. Being where he is, being in the trouble that he's always in trouble. So it's not like this was something new. You're like, oh, wow, someone was offended by what I said. Like that never happened in his life or something. He was in this place, and I think he knew that this is where he was going to end up. Because remember, God had been speaking to him for months. According to scripture, somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 months at least, this process has been going on. So he's known that something difficult was going to happen, something bad was going to happen when he got to Jerusalem, but he went anyway. But the commander of the guard, the Roman garrison, was at the end of 22 very concerned with his own well-being. Because one of the things you didn't do as a Roman was mistreat a Roman citizen without a fair trial. After the fair trial, if they were found guilty, you kind of got to do whatever you wanted. But before then, you could get in a lot of trouble for mistreating a Roman citizen. And they knew it, which is why at the end of 22, when they find out he's a citizen, even the other guards holding the whips backed up away. They were like, I don't want anything to do with this because the repercussions are not going to be kind. But we're stuck in this little cycle because the Sanhedrin made allegations. Not only did they make allegations, but they were endorsing Paul being beaten basically to death. They would have endorsed him being beaten to death as though he deserved it. But Paul was not only a Jew, he was also under the protection of Rome. This creates a big problem for the commander because he has to respect both sides, but his loyalty is to Rome. So what do you do? What the Sanhedrin didn't see when they thought they were finally going to remove this Paul problem from their midst was how his citizenship was going to create a problem. Because now that Rome has been engaged in this process, now the Sanhedrin and Paul lived. It's not like they came to take away his body. He lived. So now the Sanhedrin has to answer for their actions, and the Roman guards have to have a reason for their actions. So now Paul is in this kind of very interesting, powerful place where he is the one who's been mistreated on both sides, and now both sides have to state their case. Paul knew that he was going to be in the middle of something. And it makes me wonder, when you think about what's going on, God told Paul to go to Jerusalem. He told Paul there would be trouble. He told Paul there might even be violence. Paul goes anyway. All of his friends are telling him not to go, but he goes anyway. Because God told him to go. God had a plan, and the plan was going to have to walk through the violence that was coming. So he went anyway. Paul's path was not going to be an easy one, and it was not going to be easy because wicked men can always be counted upon to do wicked things. See, when God sends you into a place where you're going to be dealing with wicked men, you can count on those wicked men to do wicked things. But that doesn't negate the fact that God has sent you to accomplish something. And sometimes what we accomplish has to go through the difficulty in order for it to actually happen. In the description for today's message, the title of today's message is God Always Has a Plan, but in the description it says, God never promised us a smooth road, only a destination. He didn't tell you it was going to be easy to get there. He's just telling you that you'll get there. I want you to go that way. But Lord, it's scary. It's terrifying. The terrain isn't bad. I didn't ask you to critique the roadway or the smoothness of the road as it's going there. I just said, go that way. Okay, fine. And you either go or you don't. Paul's path would eventually allow him to bring the gospel directly to the ruler of Rome. And interestingly enough, there was really no other way for him to get the audiences that he was about to get except through this method. So it's interesting how God works. So let's kind of get into the middle of this. Let's talk about the Bible just for a second. We talk about as we're reading the Bible before we get into the actual point of the chapter. So when we're reading through the Bible, one of the things that we have a tendency of doing is skipping over details. But here's the truth. Details in Scripture are what unlock understanding. When you learn to ask the right questions as you're reading, you will unlock a level of understanding that has not previously been available to you. And two questions that are probably the most useful when it comes to unlocking that are, who are the people and where are the places? Are these places real? And no one is named in the Bible for no reason. You don't get your name tossed in the Bible for just no reason. The Bible is limited, has limited space, and every bit of it is valuable real estate. If the Holy Spirit is inspiring these writers to put these names in there, there's a reason. And we can count on that reason. So we need to know who these people are and what these places are and what they might mean to the account that we're reading. So in this particular account, a name you're going to hear is Ananias. Not the Ananias that got Paul back his sight. This is Ananias the high priest. Okay? Now, Ananias was a rich, selfish, violent man, but he was the high priest. Well, aren't the high priests supposed to be like, you know, vow of poverty and, you know, kind and gentle to everyone, representing God to everyone? That might be the idea, but that's not who he was. He was a rich, selfish, violent person who was known for willingly collaborating with Rome. He had very high-ranking friends in the Roman Empire. Several years before he became high priest, he was booted out of the priesthood for being implicated in an uprising between Samaritans and Jews, which got very bloody. He was found to be in the midst of it, and so they basically kicked him out of the priesthood, and his life got a little difficult for a while, but he was friends with King Agrippa's grandson. King Agrippa's the guy who died from the worms a little earlier back in Acts. It was his grandson. And through his Roman connections and with his money, the emperor, Claudius, put him back into the priesthood. And through a few series of actions, he got appointed by Rome as high priest. Huh. Well, that's convenient. So he is in one of the most powerful positions in Jerusalem because of his collaboration with Rome. And now the leader of the Roman garrison, who they were probably buddies, he probably got away with everything he wanted because, hey, if I make Ananias happy, then there's no trouble in Jerusalem. If there's no trouble in Jerusalem, then I'm happy because Rome's happy. So everyone's happy. So if they want to kill someone, go ahead and kill someone. It's fine. We don't care. But all of a sudden, Paul's citizenship becomes a big, big problem because the commander's loyalty is not to Jerusalem, it's to Rome. But now he's caught in the middle of this because the central figure, the central Jewish figure causing all the problems is Ananias. And Ananias is more connected than he is. Ananias has friends in the palace in Rome. So what do you do? How do you handle this? This is not good, okay? This is not good at all. So the commander calls in the Sanhedrin, and this is where we're going to pick it up, to make the legal case against Paul that would validate his near-death beating of a Roman citizen. He is hoping that when he calls them together, please tell me what he did that was such a grotesque violation that it warranted your actions and my subsequent actions. Tell me what happened. So basically, please make it so that I don't get in a lot of trouble for doing this. And here's where we pick it up. So in verse 1 in chapter 23, it says, now Paul, remember, this is the next day. Paul was beaten bloody the day before. He's probably not looking good at this point, okay? It says, now Paul, looking intently at the Sanhedrin, said, brothers, I have lived my life in all good conscience before God up to this day. And the high priest Ananias commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth. We don't know if Ananias knew he was a citizen of Rome. We don't know how this is playing off. But Ananias is making a power play right here. He's trying to show who has the authority, who has the power. He's trying to put Paul in his place. And by Paul saying, I am living in good standing before God, Ananias has to do something, because if he allows this to go unchecked, he's agreeing with Paul's statement. This is how things were done in the Sanhedrin. Remember, Paul is quite literally on trial at this point. But striking him in the middle of this proceeding was against the Jewish tradition, against the Jewish law. So by saying, you are not in good standing with God because you broke the law, he then breaks the law in the court. Boy, he's not paying attention to who he's got on trial. Paul is not a dummy. Paul was one, remember, Paul was not just a Pharisee, he was one of the most educated people of his day. He's smart. And so in verse 3, then Paul said to him, talking to Ananias, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. We'll talk about what that means in a second. Do you sit to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law, order me to be struck? And those standing nearby said, do you revile against the high priest of God? And Paul said, I was not aware, brothers, that he was a high priest. Which, by the way, that's not true. We're going to get to that in a second, too. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Okay. So Paul is pointing out that the action of ordering him struck by the high priest makes the high priest a rule breaker. Basically, in the Sanhedrin, he's saying, you're in violation of the law, but you got me on trial for being in violation of the law. And all the people around him, that was quite an insult. That was in this setting, this was quite an insult. Basically, he's saying, you hypocrite. So what was supposed to be a power play by Ananias turns into a dig that now he can't get out of. To the point where those around the high priest are going, hey, 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 you can't say that our high priest is not a righteous man, which is basically what Paul was saying. And Paul, remember, Paul was there the day before. Ananias was there the day before. There was not a Jew alive around the Mediterranean that did not know who the high priest was. Okay? It would be like saying, it'd be like a Catholic walking into a church and going, oh, that's the Pope? I didn't know. No one does that. Every Jew across the Mediterranean knew exactly who the high priest was, and Paul saw him yesterday. He knew exactly who the high priest was. So basically what he's saying is, he's the high priest, could have fooled me. Which was another eh. Paul is basically picking a fight. Now, he knows how the Sanhedrin works. He knows he's not going to win this fight. He already knows. So basically, all he's trying to do now is get them to fight, and he does it beautifully. Makes me think of that part on, Braveheart, where William Wallace is about to ride to the first really big fight, and then the guy goes, "Where are you going?" And he goes, "I'm going to go pick a fight." And he does, and it's pretty beautiful. Basically, this is what Paul is doing. Now, when Paul refers to him as the whitewashed wall, not to be confused with whitewashed sepulcher or whitewashed tomb. That was Jesus' statement against the Pharisees. This is slightly different. The whitewashed wall, what that meant is if you ever see someone with a retaining wall across their property, and it's like all bulged out, you know that it's just a matter of time before the thing falls apart. And instead of fixing it, they just paint it. That's what Paul's talking about. It says you are compromised, you are broken, you are corrupt. You know, you are for sale. You do not even do the job that you were here to do. You are a whitewashed wall. You are just a few days away from collapse. Says, and God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. That was a backhand in the middle of the Sanhedrin. And it's very interesting because Ananias, because of his Roman connections, during the siege of Jerusalem, which was not that far off from this point, like around 10 years, not even 10 years until this starts to happen, AD 66 to AD 70 was the fall of Jerusalem. During that time, once Rome sealed off Jerusalem and the Jewish rebels finally had their way, they knew Rome wasn't going to help anyone inside, Ananias was found hiding in an aqueduct, hiding for his life, where they pulled him out, and history says they put him to death. You can use your own imagination with that, along with everybody who worked with him. That's how much they liked their high priest. The guy used to steal the offerings that were supposed to go to the lower priesthood outside of Jerusalem. He would steal it and keep it for himself. But no one would do anything because Rome was on his side. But now the tables have turned. Rome can't be on his side. Rome has to be on the side of its citizen. This is why this is working out the way that it's working out. Now, there are several commentators that think that Paul, basically, instead of defending himself, moved to more of a viewpoint of, let's show Rome who these people really are. Now, we don't know if that's exactly what happened, but the next couple of verses really, really, really make it seem like that's the way Paul was going. So check this out. Verse 6 says, but Paul, knowing that one group were Sadducees and the other were Pharisees, he knew there were two groups here and they hated each other. Paul began crying out in the Sanhedrin, brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. I am on trial for the hope of the resurrection of the dead. That's all he had to say. They did the rest for him. And as he said this, there was dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. And there occurred a great outcry, and listen to this, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, we find nothing wrong with this man. That is a problematic statement because it means that everything that happened before was illegal. It means they had no basis for it. So this statement is a problem. They say, suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him. Well, the Sadducees now have a problem with that because they can't agree with it because it's completely against their core doctrines. So then a great dissension was developing because the commander was afraid, listen to this, that Paul would be torn to pieces by them. So this was not necessarily strictly a verbal debate. Okay? It's like one side's got his arm. No, So basically they're getting ready to rip this guy to pieces. So he ordered the troops to go down, take him away from them by force, and bring him into the barracks. That's how intense this argument was. Paul did it perfectly to show the guards who these people really were. But on that very night, the Lord stood at his side and said, "Take courage, for as you have solemnly borne witness to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must bear witness at Rome also." This argument between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, we look at it today and people make fun of it from a distance. But I gotta tell you, this is not a whole lot different than some of the arguments that we have going on in the church today. Cessationism versus continuationism. Egalitarianism versus complementarianism. Pick two opposite sides, Protestant versus Catholic, whatever. What you end up with are two people that are so convinced that their way is not only right, but it is the only way. Nothing else could be possible. So they just spend the rest of their lives hurling insults at each other and hating everyone from a distance. It's highly productive. Sometimes I think God looks down at the denominational disputes that we have and he just goes, I don't know if they actually get it at all. It doesn't matter. Now, does that mean we just embrace everything, you know, coexist? No. But even if you have a completely different understanding than another denomination, it doesn't mean that you hate the ones on the other side. You don't know where their heart is. You don't know where their mind is. You don't know where their salvation is. You can't judge them. I've said this 1,000 times. I believe with everything that's in me that there are as many saved people in the Catholic Church as there are unsaved people in the Protestant Church. But a lot of Catholics would say that, well, you can't be saved and be a Protestant. Really? Because as far as I know, Jesus wasn't Catholic. Right? But guess what? He wasn't Protestant either. Jesus was Jesus. He was the one that was right. The rest of us are just struggling to keep up. So there are some things that we can disagree on, but we are not in a place to judge the condition of another soul at any point in time. That's between them and God. Our job is to read and understand the Bible to the best of our abilities and live it every day of our lives. So Paul knew they hated each other's guts and he took full advantage of it. And the court proceedings ended very quickly. Now when you look at verse 11, on that very night, the Lord stood at his side. And when he's at night, when he's in his cell, wherever they have him barracked, the Lord appears to him and lets him know, hey, don't worry about it. You were faithful to me here. You're going to be faithful to me there. Here's all that Paul was told. I am going to get you from where you are now to in front of the main audience in Rome so you can bear my witness. You notice he didn't tell Paul any of the details of what would happen between now and then. Just told him about the destination. Didn't tell him about the journey. But here's something to think about. What was it that opened up the doors to Paul's eventual preaching in Rome? What was it that got those doors open for him? And I think this is the reason, when you go back to the last 3 or 4 chapters, what you see is Paul's friends constantly telling him, don't go to Jerusalem. Don't go. Please don't go. I know you think God is telling you to go to Jerusalem. Don't go to Jerusalem. Paul's saying, I'm supposed to go to Jerusalem. God wants me to go to Jerusalem, but there's going to be trouble there. I know. They're going to be waiting for you violently. I know. They're probably going to beat you up. I know. I think it was, two chapters ago where finally he was like, hey, come on, knock it off. What are you doing? They were in Caesarea at the time. Paul's like, we're here. We're going. Can you just support me? And finally they were like, fine, whatever. But we're going to do an I told you so later on. I think what opened up the door to Paul being able to bring the gospel to the ruler of Rome, to the emperor, was the fact that he went to Jerusalem. See, had he not gone to Jerusalem, he would not have been in the position that you're going to see in the coming chapters to be able to request an audience before Caesar. It was the very fact that he walked willingly into trouble that opened the door for the gospel to go to Rome. That makes me wonder, how many times as believers, and this is for you to ponder for yourself, do we fail because the road doesn't look like we thought it would, so we stop? Or the road doesn't look like what our friends think it should look like, and they talk us out of it. I'm talking about friends and co-laborers in Christ. They talk you out of it because, oh, I don't think you realize how difficult this is going to be. You know what? My church tried this once before, and it didn't really work that well. Well, so? Now let's put that into a modern comparison. People get on the Titanic. They try to steam across the Atlantic. It didn't go well. Now imagine if all other seafaring people took the advice of the survivors. Yeah, we tried that whole boat across the Atlantic thing before. Didn't go well. You shouldn't do it. My church tried it once, and it stank. Well, maybe it was because the wrong person was driving the boat. Maybe you just get on a better boat with a better captain. Get better advice. I don't know. Don't drive into an iceberg. There's a thing on Facebook a while ago. It says, you're probably not under spiritual attack. You just make bad decisions. And that's so true. I imagine the devil sitting back watching people's lives being blamed for all of this stuff. Devil, I bind you. And he was like, wasn't there. You need to get out of my life. I'm not in your life. That was so you. The devil made me do it. He's like, I wasn't even around. You just make bad choices. It's a great old John Wayne quote. Life is hard. It's harder if you're stupid. He's right. He's absolutely right. Sometimes I think we fail to do the things that God has asked us to do. So you can't fail. You can't not accomplish what God has put in front of you. You want to bet? Read the Old Testament. It's filled with the Jews being called by God to do something, they fail because they don't follow the instructions. If you don't believe me, there's a reason why the Israelites were wandering through the desert for 40 years, and it wasn't because God didn't give them an option to go into the land or not. We have choices, folks. Your life is not a play, and you're just sitting here reading the script. You make a choice every single day. You made a choice to get up today and come to church. While you're at church, you got to make another decision to lift up your hands in worship and to sing the words. Then during the message, you got to make another decision to either listen or check out. Believe me, I get it. Sometimes we got to follow through with the difficult things. Paul knew exactly what was coming. He did it anyway. And because he was faithful, it opened up the door to a level of ministry he could have never gotten to in any other way. He had to go through the violence to get to the opportunity. Some of us won't even go through, you know, not traveling on a good plane. I'd happily go to Africa, but I really need to fly first class. Now, as someone who's been to Africa a couple times and been on those planes, I actually agree with that. I think that if you can, you really... Those 9.5, 10, 11-hour flights, leg room, folks. And this is coming from someone with, like, basically no legs, but you need some leg space. It gets crazy. But anyway, moving along. Verse 12 says, so after this, Paul's taken away. Now listen to this. Now when it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy. This is a whole nother level of hate, folks. The Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under a curse, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. And there were more than 40 who formed this scheme. This is a big party of assassins. I mean, you're talking, we need to get rid of this guy. This is a lot of hate. They came to the chief priests and the elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a curse to taste nothing until we have killed Paul." They bound themselves under this before they had actually talked to the priest. They were simply informing the priest what their intentions were. "So now you, along with the Sanhedrin, notify the commander to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case more carefully. Say, cool heads, we're better now. Bring him down and we'll tell you what was going on. And we, for our part, are ready to slay him before he comes near." But when the son of Paul's sister heard their ambush, so his little nephew was in town, he came and entered the barracks and reported it to Paul. And Paul came, called one of the centurions to him and said, "Lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him." So he took him and led him to the commander and said, "Paul, the prisoner, called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you since he has something to tell you." And the commander took him by the hand, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, "What is it that you have to report to me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the Sanhedrin." And though they were going to inquire somewhat more carefully, remember this was early in the morning, so this is kind of going on throughout the day, they were going to inquire somewhat more carefully about him. "So do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of them who have bound themselves under a curse not to eat or drink until they slay him are lying in wait for him. And now they are ready and waiting for the promise from you." So the commander let the young man go, instructing him, "Tell no one that you have notified me of these things." Remember in verse 11, God did not say nothing tricky is going to happen between now and then. So here comes Paul's cousin. This is the next day. Paul is woken up after God saying, "Hey, doing a good job in Jerusalem. You're heading to Rome. It's going to be good. Don't worry about it." Now comes, you know, nephew Bob. "Hey, Paul. There's like 40-something guys that are going to try to kill you tomorrow. Just thought you'd like to know. I'm heading home, just in case you want to do something about it." So what does Paul do? Paul trusts the Lord. He says, "All right, go tell that guy." So he does. This was not a small deal. Okay, there would not have been 40 guards bringing Paul down to the Sanhedrin. There probably would have been 8, maybe 12. So they would have all died. These 40 plus men would have known many of them would have died in the attempt of taking Paul's life. So here's something to know about Roman guards. They don't use their swords and spears to wound. Okay? Sword and a spear, when you pull your sword out, there's only one thing left to do, and that is to get rid of the enemy. So anyone involved in this, if they could kill you, they would. Remember, these guys are thinking that their life is in danger too. They're going to fight, and they're going to fight hard, and they're trained. So they're very good with these weapons. But that would not only cause an issue with the temple, it could very easily cause a riot in the city. If the Jews in the city get wind of the idea that Rome is killing its citizens, there would be an uprising, and that would lead to a lot of deaths, Jews, Romans, and Samaritans. And you know who's going to take the blame for that? The commander. So now the commander has got this issue. Okay, so now I got this high priest, this idiot who used to be my friend, who's got friends in Rome in the palace. The emperor liked this guy. Now he is making so much trouble that there is about to be a massive uprising because of this Paul guy who just had to be a citizen. And now he's sending people to assassinate. I'm going to lose soldiers. People are going to die. What in the world am I going to do? How am I going to fix this? Aha! Overkill. That's how we fix it. You want to make a point? Make a big one. You want to make a statement? Make the statement. So he decides to not only make a statement to the people in Jerusalem, but he is going to end this. He's going to get rid of this problem for himself. And he does something that is absolutely amazing, okay? Now, keep in mind that in Jerusalem, there was one garrison that is at most 1,000 soldiers, okay? That's about 1,000 soldiers. And this is what he decides to do. And when he had called to him two centurions, centurions are typically responsible for at least 100 men. Sometimes it could be two, depending on how things were set up. And he said, make ready 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to proceed to Caesarea by the third hour of the night, which means today. How many people is that? 470 soldiers, half of the military presence in Jerusalem, is about to accompany Paul to Governor Felix. Now, 100 soldiers would have been more than enough to take care of 40 untrained Jews with knives, okay? But why make a small point when you can make a big one? So the trip to the governor, Felix, was not a small one. It was about 60-something miles. It was quite a ways to Caesarea. The average journey for a soldier would be 20 miles per day. 20 miles, when you're carrying everything you need, all of your weapons, all of your food, all of your water, everything you're going to need for the trip, on your back, 20 miles is a long way to go, especially in the third hour of the night, which at this point was either going to be somewhere between 9 o'clock and midnight, depending on when the sun set. These guys are starting after they've been up all day, which means they ain't sleeping. So this is a forced march. He says, get ready, 470 men, and get Paul out of here. That's some serious overkill. But I think my favorite part is the absolutely hilarious letter that the commander sends with Paul to the governor. Now, you already know what has happened with Paul to this point, and this is the letter that he sends with, give this to Governor Felix with my compliments. And he says this, and he wrote a letter having this form, Claudius Lysias, that's the commander, to the most excellent Governor Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came upon them with troops and rescued him. And then I tied him to a post and was about to beat him to death. But you know what? Don't worry about that. Having learned that he was a Roman, because I am thorough, and wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their Sanhedrin, and I found him to be accused over a question about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. Which I was going to do both, but it's fine. That's another side note. And when I was informed that there would be a plot against this man, I was so worried that I sent half of my military presence to send him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to speak against him before you. So he sent a letter to the Sanhedrin, basically letting them know, I know what you're doing. You want to argue with him? Go talk to Felix. Talk about glossing over the truth. Basically, he's trying to make it look like he is so concerned about Paul that there's no way he was going to let one of his citizens be harmed. Now, it was not uncommon for lower-level Roman officials to kick things upwards, especially if it was something that was going to involve a lot of violence. Remember, this could, at this time, the Jews and the Romans were not necessarily friends. They were continually at each other's throat, which is one of the reasons why Claudius appointed Ananias as high priest. He was hoping that that Roman connection into the priesthood would calm things down. It didn't. All the Jews hated the high priest, and it just made things worse. So now we're moving along in this direction again, and what they don't want is open rebellion, which, like I said, is only a few years down the road. So you kick that up to a higher level of authority so that you don't get in trouble for the issue. And this is where we come to an end here. It says, the soldiers, according to their roles, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. 36 miles overnight. That's a march. That's from Jerusalem to this castle, and we'll get to that in a second. I'll show you where that is, and I'll show you a picture of what it looks like today. Excuse me. From Jerusalem to that point is the hilliest, roughest terrain of the entire journey. Because Jerusalem is more elevated, and so getting down to it, you're going through all kinds of hills and valleys, perfect places for ambushes, especially when you're going overnight. And so they made this very difficult journey in one night. It says, but the next day, leaving the horsemen, which remember was 70 of them, to go on with him, they returned to the barracks. And when they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. Basically like, take this guy, we don't want to do anything to deal with him. And when he had read it, he asked from what province he was, and when he learned that he was from Cilicia, which means it was a Roman province, it means he had standing, okay? He said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive. Basically, I'm going to keep you a prisoner until they show up, and you're going to remain a prisoner until this is settled. Giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. Okay, so these are all little bits of archaeology and history that we don't necessarily understand. And so when you start to think of where Jerusalem is, all the way to Antipatris, it's 36 miles through all of that rough terrain. From Antipatris to Caesarea is 27. It's all flat. Remember, Paul was just on this road a few days ago. From Caesarea, he went up to Jerusalem on the same road. So he knows it very well. And now he's walking back to Felix. I'm wondering if he's thinking, why didn't I just beat up a Roman in Caesarea and then get before Felix? That would have made it so much easier. So the Roman fortress, this is what it looks like today. Pretty good size, right? Most of the little windows, if you look down in the bottom, a person or two people could sit in those windows. They were made for if the castle was under siege, you could use bows and stuff to launch stuff to people below you. So it's interesting when these places are named, and whenever they're named, I try to show you what these are real places. This isn't just some made-up place. So they stop here, 400 of them go home. Can you imagine that? You take an overnight, 400 of you take an overnight walk to this castle, 70 of the guys on horses get to keep going, and where do you go? You're walking back to Jerusalem. This completely sounds like a military exercise, right? Walk that way until you're exhausted, sit down for a minute, and then walk back. It's a great idea. And he came to the house of Felix. Felix gives him a trial. So this is the home that Paul would be staying in through his trial. This is what it looks like today. This is what it looked like. Basically, this is an artist's rendition of what it would have looked like back in Paul's day. Paul would spend the next 2 years as a prisoner here. He would have he would be able to roam the grounds freely, but he wouldn't be allowed to leave the footprint of the facility. His caretakers could come and go. They would bring him food. They would bring him clothes. They would carry letters out. But he spent 2 years here waiting for the whole trial to be finished. Could you imagine being charged with something? And before you can actually get this taken care of legally, you spend 2 years battling this, and you can't leave your home. It's not even your home, actually. I would be a little frustrated. I'd be thinking, God, didn't you say, like, Rome? We're going to Rome, right? Like, tell me we're going to Rome.
Hey, thanks for joining us. We're glad you could be here. We had to cut this sermon a little short for our time here on the radio, but if you'd like to hear or see more, watch our service live on Facebook, YouTube, or visit our website at www.riveroflifechurch.org. We hope you have a great week.